It's Thursday, April 17th, 2008. I'm Kevin Grau, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Ora Peskovitz for the Indiana University School of Medicine History Project. Dr. Peskovitz, just to get started, if you could tell me a bit about your education and background, and people will share the story about why medicine in the first place, what drew you to medicine.
I think maybe what drew me to medicine was a class that I took in ninth grade called Research and Development. I was the only girl in the class, and the class required a year-long self-study project where you designed experiments and then to test a hypothesis, reported on the results, and discussed what they meant. And I had the good fortune of being able to do that project at the National Institutes of Health, so a real institution, and I became very excited about the ability to ask and answer questions that might have great impact on human beings. So I think about that time I decided that I would become interested in a career in as a physician scientist. I was at that point in my life debating between a career in music and a career in science. I played the piano pretty seriously then and considered doing that. I ended up going to a six-year medical program at Northwestern, something called the Honors Program in Medical Education, which was a combination of college and medical school together. And I started that in 1974 and graduated in 1979. With a bachelor's and an MD.
When you finished Northwestern, where did you go next?
I followed my soon-to-be husband to the University of Minnesota to do the first part of my pediatric residency. I did the first year and a half there. And then my husband and I moved to Washington, D.C. for 4 years, where I completed my residency and then did a three-year fellowship in pediatric endocrinology at the National Institutes of Health.
So early in your career, who were the most important figures in terms of mentoring your development as a researcher?
From a scientific perspective?
Yes.
Without a doubt, the most important individuals in my career development were my mentors at the NIH. Mm-hmm. In particular, Lynn Loriaux, L-O-R-I-A-U-X. It's actually D. Lynn, L-Y-N-N. Loriaux, who's currently the chairman of the Department of Medicine in Oregon, and another mentor, Gordon Cutler, Gordon B. Cutler, Jr. Two endocrinologists, actually adult endocrinologists, not pediatric endocrinologists, who taught me about the thrill of discovery and how one could identify new things that would ultimately impact human beings. Lynn's motto always was, go for it, and that motto that you know, the sky's the limit, just go for it. It has stuck with me to this day.
And as a clinician and as a physician, were there other individuals who were important mentors at the time?
I think I had a number of other physician mentors. A wonderful, also at the NIH, a wonderful clinician endocrinologist who was also a researcher named Fernando Cazorla. He really was a phenomenal clinician, more than the others were. They were better scientists. He was a better clinician. And he really taught me about the gift that is involved in caring for patients, beyond the medical knowledge, but how one interacts with patients, bedside matter, how one listens to children and families. I think I was really fortunate to have outstanding professional mentors.
Did you, as you approached a career in pediatric endocrinology, which came first for you, peds or endocrinology?
Interesting story, actually. When I went to medical school, from the time I started in medical school, people said, well, you're a woman. It was in an era where there were not a lot of women in medicine, certainly not like today. And they said, well, if you're going to be a doctor, you may as well be a children's doctor because women are so good with children. And so I said, well, that's the last thing in the world I'm going to be is a children's doctor because they all assume I'm going to be a children's doctor, so I'm going to be anything but. And so I was able to make arrangements to move my required third year medical student, a required course in pediatrics, to my fourth year so that I would make a career decision before I experienced pediatrics, just so I'd be sure that I wouldn't like it. And then I was a senior medical student and did the required pediatric rotation, and all of a sudden sort of realized, who am I kidding here? And realized that I very much wanted to, I very much connected with children and their families. And there were a number of things that really drew me to pediatrics. Probably first and foremost was the idea that the problems that children experienced were never due to their own fault. In contrast to so many adult diseases, if you look at the costs of healthcare in our country, so much of it is avoidable if people didn't smoke, if they ate properly, if they exercised. And so many diseases are a result of lifestyle choices. It always bothered me that we wouldn't have these healthcare problems. We wouldn't have to take care of these people if they only took care of themselves. In contrast, in pediatrics, it's never a child's fault. Either they're born with a congenital problem, or even the ones that are environmental, they're not the child's fault. They're always children in a situation where there's, you know, maybe poverty or inadequate access to healthcare or abuse, but the child is never responsible for whatever befalls him or her. And that really was a very important thing for me. The other thing that I actually found interesting was that the other pediatricians that I worked with when I was a student, I realized I was more like in terms of life values, outlook on the world, sense of purpose and mission. Commitment and dedication that pediatricians seem to have, and other physicians do too, but as a group I was drawn to them in addition to these other things. So I pretty much couldn't fight it anymore after realizing that, you know, this was what it was. But I never intended to do general pediatrics. I always envisioned being in an academic medical center. I was always, it was very important to me to be involved in the cutting edge of research. And I never saw myself as a general pediatrician.
When you'd finished your subspecialty work, completed residency, and you knew you wanted to go to an academic medical center, what were the choices that you had in front of you?
Not very many choices. And actually, maybe I'll just take a step back before that. I had fewer choices than the typical graduating student had. Most students, when they choose a field after graduating or in the last year of medical school, they choose what they want to go into and then they apply through the residency matching program that exists. Because I was following my husband, who was already where he was in Minneapolis, there was only one pediatric residency and there was no assurance that I would be accepted into that residency. And so I actually applied for four different residencies. Pediatrics was my first choice, but I applied for pediatrics, obstetrics and gynecology, psychiatry, and neurology, and was accepted, actually, as it turns out, outside of the match, into pediatrics as my first choice, but would have been willing to compromise and do any of those other specialties as well. So I think that's just maybe a little bit of an interesting thing from a historical perspective in terms of the times and the options and the flexibility that I think you need to have to consider different careers. And I would have been happy doing any of those things, but peds was my first choice.
When you arrived at Minnesota and began working the program, was it an easy transition? Did you find that the kinds of work that you were interested in would be supported there? Or did you find yourself heading in a new direction?
The first time I went as a resident, I felt very much at home. Although I have to say, also from a historical perspective, residencies have changed a great deal over these 20 plus years because, more than 20 years, almost 30 years, Because residencies at that time were pretty brutal, and this one in particular kind of prided itself on the number of residents that left or committed suicide. It was brutal. Minnesota used to say that their pediatric residency was the Harvard of the Midwest, and the reason I ended up with a slot outside of the match was because a resident had committed suicide, and I was asked to fill in. You know, it was another era. But I did have everything I expected that first time. After leaving the NIH, after my fellowship was completed, which was without a doubt the most extraordinary part of my training, my 3 years at the NIH, I went back to the University of Minnesota because my husband had to complete his residency and his transplantation fellowship. That time, it was very difficult. And that time, I was actually not offered a position. I completed my endocrine fellowship with 27 publications. I had already developed a national reputation from my research experience, and I was not offered a job. And in fact, I had two babies at that time, and I was so not offered a job that I interviewed with an HMO in Minneapolis. That was the hubbub and the origin of HMOs in the United States in the 1980s. This was 1985. And I applied for a job at an HMO as a general pediatrician. And it was actually the first time I had an actual rejection in my life. I was rejected from a big HMO from being a general pediatrician because I was believed to be overqualified, and they knew that I was interested in academia and thought that at the first opportunity I might leave and go try to get a university appointment. I was already an endocrinologist, and they thought I wouldn't do general pediatrics. My intent was to sign a contract and do exactly what the contract said, but I would have signed a 3-year contract and then gone on to seek an academic opportunity. At the very end, the chairman of surgery, who is a very prominent surgeon in Minnesota, very well-known person historically, John Najarian, contacted the chairman of pediatrics and sort of pleaded with them to make a position for me. And they did. I was an instructor. And paid less than I was paid as a fellow. It was a demeaning move. My mentors from the NIH, who were wonderfully supportive of me in my career, went so far as to suggest that I should leave my husband and go to Harvard, where I had a very nice offer, rather than to go to Minnesota, where they were doing me this great favor by giving me a job. But as I said, I had two babies and a husband, and chose to make a decision that was best for my family, although at the time it was did not look like it was the best thing for my career.
And obviously your generational experience is very much, you know, in the first generation where couples looked at both careers as being sort of mutually important, mm-hmm. Rather than sort of more traditional model where you find many women in the history of science and medicine who end up in sort of non-tenure track career paths because mm-hmm. they, in order to keep their personal lives the way they want them, have deferred mm-hmm. to this kind of discrimination that tends to persist. Mm-hmm. So when you, it sounds as if when you were at Minnesota, the opportunity arose for both of you to move somewhere else, that would be something that you would find appealing?
Well, actually, no. Mm-hmm. I will say a couple things about it. I did make 4 moves that were my husband's primary choice. Mm-hmm. The move to Minnesota, the move from Minnesota to Washington, mm-hmm. the move back to Minnesota, and the move here to Indiana. Mm-hmm. Those 4 moves I made because of my husband's lead. But at the time that we moved to Indiana, I was very happy in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. By that point, which was 3 years after the story I just told mm-hmm. you, I had a third child and an NIH grant, which was difficult to achieve. My research was successful. I was rapidly promoted from instructor to assistant professor, and was very, felt very comfortable in that setting. Was very well respected, had wonderful colleagues and friends and mentors, and it was a very comfortable environment. So the last thing in the world I wanted to do actually was to be uprooted again.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't want to move again at that point. I wasn't like I was waiting for the next opportunity. And then again, it was a very difficult move because my husband had finished his training and was now looking for his first
mm-hmm.
primary appointment. He started before me but finished after me.
Right.
Because of the 4 years, first of all, surgery was a longer training period, plus he took 4 years out in the middle to do basic laboratory-based immunology research. So we looked, we both went out looking for positions. We both had excellent offers at various places, but we never both had excellent offers at the same place. That was a difficult thing for me to consider letting him take the lead. After all, I'd done it three times before, but it wasn't nearly as difficult as the time before. And one of the things that I had learned from the time before was that I was adaptable, that I could be flexible, and really that everything would turn out okay. I had so much trepidation over that, and that move from Washington to Minneapolis. But after that was so, turned out to be successful. I actually developed a certain confidence in my ability to be flexible and adapt and make it, something that I didn't have prior to that. I didn't have the experience to give me that history. The other thing is that the reason that I followed my husband as opposed to him following me wasn't really primarily a sexist thing at all. I mean, even for the generation or the time period, when I think back on it, I don't really think of it as that. I think it was because his field was more specialized,
mm-hmm.
and I was a very flexible person, and I had decided that I could do things outside of even medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when we were coming here and there was no job originally offered to me, I had another idea, an entrepreneurial idea for starting a medical business,
mm-hmm.
Actually an endocrinology medical business that I had in mind that I would do if I weren't able to get a position. I also thought about being a docent in the art museum, and I thought about a variety of other things that I could do. And while they weren't my first choice, the second choices were okay.
Mm-hmm.
And by that point, I realized that it didn't matter as much.
Mm-hmm.
And it did matter more for my husband. Also, I realized that he would be, at that stage in our lives, it was true, the primary breadwinner. And that, therefore, it was important for him to be in a place that was going to be satisfactory. And then finally, I have to admit that as a pediatrician, I saw so many children with so many illnesses that I always had it in the back of my mind that if, God forbid, something happened to any one of my three children that required a parent to be at home, that there was no doubt in my mind that I would want to be the home parent. Therefore, if we were going to make a career choice decision that was mine and then something happened, I always worried that my husband would be in a less than optimal place for him, and I could potentially end up leaving my job in order to take care of the children full time. So I never thought about staying home full time. I only thought about it from the perspective if a child had a life threatening or chronic illness that required a full time parent. So those were all considerations, and that's why I really, after we looked together and didn't find ideal positions together, I really advised my husband that he should find the position that suited him best first, and that happened to be here.
Mm-hmm. And so you came here in
1988.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was becoming increasingly common for medical schools competing for researchers. You know, when someone was coming in, they'd be offering a package. And obviously, you had NIH money when you left Minnesota, and now you're coming to someplace without a position,
mm-hmm.
without an offer. And so that makes your experience very interesting in the sense of what was it like to come here in something of an outsider status? That is, you hadn't been anointed.
Yeah, I wasn't. I had not even met the other
mm-hmm.
doctors in the department.
Mm-hmm.
I only met the chair.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what was your experience like when you arrived here?
This is a little detour. I know it's taped, so you can do whatever you want with this, but did you see the big break article that they had last Sunday that I had written for the Star?
No, you know, I was out of town last night.
Okay,
I haven't
okay.
finished
Well,
yet.
because I'm going to repeat some of
Oh,
what's in
sorry.
there. Well, some of this is in there,
Right.
actually, but that's okay. I will repeat it anyway. So I wasn't really offered a position here either. Dr. Grossfeld, who was not only the head of pediatric surgery, but also the chairman of surgery, was recruiting my husband. And Dr. Schreiner had been chair of pediatrics for 10 days when Dr. Grossfeld called him and said, "I want to recruit this surgeon whose wife needs a position in pediatrics. Can you find her something in pediatrics?" And I actually kept a letter which I read at Dr. Grossfeld's Festschrift. People cracked up because the letter was addressed, it was before we came, and the letter was addressed to Mark. It said, "Dear Mark," I'll find the letter if you want to see it because it's actually, it is interesting. It said, "We're so excited that you are interested in coming to Indiana University. And I know that you're worried about your wife. I assure you that we will find something for Mrs. Peskovitz to do in Indiana." So it was just very funny, both because they found something, more than one thing, as it turns out, for me to eventually do. And he called me Mrs. Peskovitz. And it was just an interesting reflection, both on the times and, you know, the history of what happened. When I read this letter at his Festschrift, so many people there knew me. I was speaking at the Festschrift as the Riley CEO honoring Dr. Grossfeld. It was quite humorous. But Dr. Grossfeld, there wasn't a laboratory for me to move my NIH grant to in the Department of Pediatrics. There were very few basic research projects in the department. And so Dr. Grossfeld had this little old lab that was poorly equipped but was spaced. And he was so anxious to recruit my husband that he said, "You can move your NIH grant to my lab." But it was a big deal for, in retrospect, it was a big deal for the department to get an investigator fall into their lab. And I wasn't smart enough or knowledgeable enough or experienced enough to do what people do for me with me today, which is to ask for a package. I really didn't. I said, and this is what was quoted in the article, I said, "I need a few things. I need a small office where I can pump breast milk because my youngest child was still breastfeeding. So I need to be able to close a door. I need to have access to a laboratory so that I can continue my NIH research. I need to have access to patients who need to be treated. And I want to have access to learners who want to learn." And Dr. Schreiner said, "Sure, it's all yours, whatever you want." But I didn't ask for anything else. So that's what I got. I got what I asked for, but not one penny more. Then I discovered something about the institution that I think is a remarkable characteristic of Indiana University that was true for me 20 years ago and still remains true today. This is something that belongs in our history. This is important. I felt so fortunate that somebody gave me a job because they created it, basically. They didn't need me. So when I arrived, I looked around and I said, "Nobody's watching over me. There are no expectations of me. They don't really care what I do." But at the same time that I realized that there was no accountability and no expectations, I also began to realize that there was no limit to what I could do because nobody said no, like they do in many other institutions. And so while nothing was handed to me on a silver platter, at the same time, I began to realize that there were no obstacles to achieving various things. And so in my relationship with Dr. Schreiner, I discovered that I could go in and give him suggestions about a plan. I could say, for example, early on, I said, "You know, this would be a great place to create an endocrine training program, a great place to create a fellowship so we could train future endocrinologists." And he said, "Well, why not? You know, I don't see a problem with that. What do you need?" And I would tell him, "Well, before we can develop a fellowship, we really need to have a few more endocrinologists because you can't train people until you have a breadth and depth of trainees, of faculty." So I said, "I need enough money to be able to recruit another two endocrinologists." So he'd say, "Okay." So the first year I'd ask for $10,000 and I'd promise that I would produce a certain product. I'd go in the next year to him and I'd say, "You know, Rich, Last year I was in here, I asked you for $10,000. I told you I'd produce X. You gave me the $10,000. I produced 2X. This year I need $50,000. And I will produce 3X. And I'd go in the next year and say, you gave me $50,000. I produced 6X. So now I need you to give me $200,000. And it went on like that for year after year after year, to the point that our pediatric endocrine division today is widely acknowledged as a premier place in the country, 12 plus outstanding pediatric endocrinologists, half of whom were trained here in that fellowship program that we eventually developed, and half of whom were recruited here from the outside. And they are so, it's so desirable, you'll find this interesting as a parent, but it's so desirable today that we have two retired pediatric endocrinologists who are gods in the field of pediatric endocrinology, one from Pittsburgh and one from UVA, who retired, you know, they finished their careers. They come here and spend between a quarter and a half time because this is such an exciting place for them to spend their retirement. We hardly pay them anything. They practically pay us to be here. It's become such an extraordinary place. And it wasn't on the map when we started.
Let me ask a few questions about that time.
Yeah.
One is when Dr. Schreiner is handing you money.
Not a lot of money.
Not a lot of money. But this is, I'm assuming this is general departmental money.
Yes.
So it's coming out of the general departmental budget. Dollar, are they mainly dollars that are derived from sort of the clinical care?
They are. They are mostly dollars that came from subsidy from sections in the department that actually brought in more dollars than they paid their faculty. So typically, neonatology, one year, in fact, one of those years, I don't remember which one, but one of those years, Rich came to me and said that Dr. Lemons, who is the director of neonatology, was so impressed with what I wanted to do in my area that he was personally taking surplus from neonatology and giving it to endocrinology so that we could continue the direction that we had. Dr. Lemons probably doesn't know this. I hope he can read this one day because I'm very indebted to him to this day for doing that. So there was that sense in the department, and this was one of the characteristics that I'm referring to, that while nobody said to you, why don't you do this? If you said, I have this idea to accomplish this, you could find partners by the dozens who would say, tell me how I can help. It's a good idea. Tell me what I can do to help you. And that was really true of my 20 years here.
And did you find that that kind of sense of collegiality and sort of looking for partners, did it exist simply within the Department of Pediatrics, or did it
No.
go across the whole school?
I didn't actually know much about the whole school until I actually, a few years before I moved into this dean's office. But it's a quality and characteristic which I believe is true of the entire institution. Certainly the School of Medicine. It's very true of the entire institution today.
This, you know, stepping out of time a minute and taking a little bit more synthetic view, given the size of this institution, and, you know, how, 20 years later, what sort of cultural norms or values or practices tend to support this sort of openness and this sort of collegiality?
Well, let me just say, I always worried it was a double-edged sword, and I want to maybe explain what I mean by that. No doubt that's a wonderful characteristic, and it's one that I applaud, and I tell you it's a fantastic thing. It's a positive strength. I always worried that it was associated with a negative quality, and worried about this more when I became the dean for research, executive associate dean for research, than I had ever really contemplated it previously. And what I mean by that is that I always, when I compared us to other institutions that didn't have that collegiality, I noted that they were more competitive institutions, which actually, from a ranking perspective, ranked higher than we did, significantly higher than we did. And I always worried that those two things were associated. In other words, if you were so competitive that you wanted to be ranked top, that went along with a competitive nature and a drive and an ambition and a fire in the belly and a willing to be territorial and to step on other people's toes, that was not associated with the collegiality that we had. And so while when I became the dean for research, and my goal was to ramp up research at IU School of Medicine, I always had this worry, and still do a little bit today, that when we do that, will we create an unintended consequence of making these nice people a little bit less nice? I don't think we've done that yet, but we're also not in the top tier. And so, you know, it remains to be proven whether or not those things are truly associated.
This may be asking you to sort of treat in hypotheticals, or, but do you think that that apparent tension between the sort of competitiveness internally and the and collegiality, is it in part because, or could it be that those institutions where they're research across a wide range of subspecialties is so strong that they're so closely associated with and tied into the values of their discipline, that sort of the disciplinary values and disciplinary goals trump institutional values within the institutional setting where they work?
Now you're getting me to the topic that I'm really thinking about right now in my own life. I'm thinking of writing on this, actually. You know the issue of the prisoner's dilemma?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm spending a lot of time. This is where I am today. This is not historical. This is what I'm struggling with today. I worry about the tension between the selfish and the selfless, the common good and the individual good, the altruistic motive and the selfish or, you know, egotistic motive. And there is that tension, and that prisoner's dilemma actually is an example of why you have it, because they are not always aligned. So if you take that from the individual to the subunits that you're referring to, so now you're talking about all the neonatologists versus all the endocrinologists, or the Department of Pediatrics versus the Department of Surgery, or the School of Medicine versus IU Bloomington. You know, you could take it to any macro level that you want. There is that natural tension that occurs between what is good for the individual or the unit and what is for the common good. And I actually find myself today struggling with that more than I did in the past. I would say that what breaks it down at the level as big as a school, the School of Medicine, is the sense of collegiality across the whole school. So that when there's a commonality of purpose and mission and goals with and strategy, strategic planning within the school, it is my sense that we don't have that. In other words, but part of that sometimes requires having a common outside enemy. Because it's been my impression, and this is not limited to us, but institutions have to, if they have to have that drive to get better, it's better than something. It isn't ever just solely competitive with yourself, even though that would be an ideal. And that requires psychologically creating an outside force. And so I think we still are above having much of that internal tension. I'm almost wondering when you have to have it level in order to really be truly successful. And if you're not, how hard is it to be happy? And if you're too happy and too content, then you're complacent. Then there's nothing that pushes you to drive harder, to get better, to move higher, you know. And my personal motto is, I like two versions of this, but, you know, Robert Browning's, a man's reach should always exceed his grasp for what is heaven for. And Michelangelo, who said, you know, if you achieve your aims, then your aim is too low. So, you know, both versions of that are sort of what drive me. But then when you're pushing all the time, you're pushing against something. And then there's that natural tension that occurs between the self, or whatever the self is, however big that unit is, and the outside of self.
Taking a step back to when you arrived in the late 80s, what was your perception before you arrived to the degree you had one of pediatric Patrick's at IU. What did it mean? You know, what was it sort of, you know, what was the values it carried with, you know, it sort of resonated with? And also, you've indicated that research was a very small part of what was going on at the time. And so how did the Department of Pediatrics relate to some of these sections of the medical school where research was a bigger component, such as the, you know, Department of Medicine? So.
Let me just say, there were pockets of excellence in research in the department. I think probably the most important one was in neonatology, mm-hmm. actually, because this preceded the creation of the Well Center,
mm-hmm.
so which created a new era in research in the Department of Pediatrics. But I didn't sense any tension between the research that existed in pediatrics and the rest of the school. But I also may not have been in a position to note it. You know, in other words, you may want to talk to people who experience a different look at the elephant. From my perspective, I had neutral to negative impressions of the department. I knew what the best departments of pediatrics were in the country, and this wasn't one. I had never heard of Riley Hospital for Children. I really knew nothing about Indiana University. I said to my husband when he called from here, when he was here doing his interview before I had visited, where is Indiana place? I really knew nothing about Indiana except that it was where rednecks were.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard about the Ku Klux Klan
mm-hmm.
story here. I knew a little bit about the eugenics history
mm-hmm.
from Indiana. And it was probably the last place in the world I would have chosen to go, both personally and professionally. I didn't know bad things other than that history,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't know good things at all. And so it was, I was resigned, is sort of how I would say that I felt, but not so negatively as I was when I went to Minnesota, because I knew that I'd be okay.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, as I said, I had three little children. I had a children 10 months, 1.5, and 3 at the time. And so you know what I did so that I would not be depressed about not going to my first choice? I spent a lot of time thinking about the fact that the house that we bought, which we bought with sight unseen, I bought it from a blueprint, that I would get to pick the carpet and that I would decorate it. And I spent a lot of time focusing my energies on everything but the institution. Because I was preparing myself to be very disappointed with the institution. I wasn't willing to be unhappy, so I was going to find my satisfaction someplace else. I was going to work, but I was just not, I expected I'd end up with a different kind of career.